The University City Science Center supports WHYY. In Greater Philadelphia, innovation means business, and the Science Center is at the core of that business. They unite our region's entrepreneurial ecosystem, convening the resources, funders, and people that move ideas forward. For more than 50 years, the Science Center has helped transform ambition into success, fueling the growth that strengthens our region. The University City Science Center. More information at sciencecenter.org. That's sciencecenter.org.
I've been coming here my whole life. I just love coming to the beach.
It's calm. It's family. Kids can play and scream and nobody yells at them. And there's lifeguards.
We come to the beach as much as we possibly can.
I love it because it's so peaceful and it's not very crowded.
I just love Lewis Beach.
Welcome to Lewis, Delaware, and for everybody assembled here at Canal Front Park, what a beautiful night. Thanks so much for coming out. I'm Dave Heller, and this is a special Shore broadcast of NewsWorks Tonight. Now, during the next half hour, we'll bring you the sounds, voices, and stories of Delaware's beaches. Never been to Lewis? Well, joining me to start off our show with a bit of the history of the town is Mike DiPaolo, Executive Director of the Lewis Historical Society. Mike, thanks for trucking all the way down here from the Historical Society, which I think I can see just across the road a piece.
It's a long block and a half.
Well, I took a little sojourn on my bike just down the road a bit, and I came across the plaque commemorating the first European settlers to come up the Delaware Bay, I think back in 1631, making Lewis the first town in the first state.
That's correct.
It didn't end up so well for them, though.
It did not, but thankfully for us it did. Back in 1631, the Dutch sent a whaling contingent over here to whale the waters of Delaware Bay. They had heard from Henry Hudson that the waters off the Atlantic coast were full of whales, and they were interested in bringing the oil back here, back to the Netherlands, and make a profit off of it. The settlement here in 1631 was known as Swanendale.
There are neither swans nor whales here anymore.
Nor whales nor vales either. Valleys here. This is a very flat country down here. And Swanendale translates as Valley of the Swans. So the first settlement here in 1631 was known as Swanendale. And the men who came here, again, they were sailors primarily looking for whales. And unfortunately, they had a bit of a misunderstanding with the local Native American population. We're not quite sure what happened but to lead to this event, but all 32 men who were here were tragically murdered by the local Native American population. And this happened in early to mid-1631. And what makes it really significant for Lewis and for what would eventually become the state of Delaware is that it predated by about a year the first settlement in Maryland, which was in 1632. And if it hadn't been for the settlement here in Lewis, the state of Delaware would not exist. It's the actual legal reason for the sovereignty of the state of Delaware was a settlement here in 1631. Lord Baltimore received a patent to Maryland in 1632 that said he could have all the land south of the 40th degree parallel and north of Potomac River, which of course would include the current state of Delaware. But he didn't notice in his charter there was a clause that said, basically, and this is a loose translation from the Latin, that he couldn't claim any land that had been previously cultivated by basically Christian men. And he had no idea the Dutch were here and never really tried to settle over here. It was always much more financially advantageous to focus on the Chesapeake. And fast forward a couple decades to the 1680s, when William Penn gets his proprietorship to Pennsylvania. He says, you know, I'd like to have some land extending down to the sea so Philadelphia is not landlocked. Then there's a big confrontation between the Penns and the Calverts.
Now, the Historical Society in Lewis started up in 1961, and you were involved with refurbishing many of the structures, some of which date back to the 17th century, the Rives Holt House, for example.
Yes, that's the oldest building still standing in the state of Delaware. It's on 2nd and Mulberry Street. It's part of the Historical Society buildings and is currently our visitor center right in the heart of the commercial district in town here.
Of course, this city reeks of history, but at one point it reeked of fish, and that acted as a kind of deterrent to keep from tourists, certainly, from coming down.
That's right. In the 1880s, a Menhaden fishing plant was established here in Lewis and was here in town until the 1960s, but really, in the 1940s and into the 1950s, Lewis was the largest fishing port in the country. bar none. You know, sometimes we think of ports in New England or in Alaska or California or the Pacific Northwest, but this small oily fish called the menhaden were caught here by the millions of tons. Processed here for their oil, they would be turned into fertilizer, the fish scraps into fertilizer. The oil was used in a variety of commercial purposes, everywhere from the base of some paints to a key ingredient in dynamite and even in ladies' mascara. So menhaden had a variety of uses. And you're right, the stench from the fish factory kept Lewis sort of off the map. There's actually a great quote from a news article in the 1940s that mentions how folks from D.C. would always go to the Rehoboth Beach or Bethany Beach, but they wouldn't come here because it stank to high heaven.
On this 50th anniversary of the Cape May Lewis Ferry, talk about how that endeavor put Lewis back on the map.
Sure. Well, in the 1950s, the fisheries are booming. By 1963, there's a dramatic decline in the fisheries. And by 1967, they're actually closed. And so in 1964, the Cape May Lewis Ferry comes along. And you have a town that is looking for new commercial and business endeavors. And I think the town fathers at the time saw the ferry as a literal and figurative vehicle to bring people here, to keep the young people engaged here, to keep them here looking for jobs. And I don't think they saw Lewis as a tourism destination. For decades, it had been an industrial town, a blue-collar town, and I think that they had intentions of that it would probably remain that way with the ferry. But you have the collapse of the fisheries, the rise of the ferry, a burgeoning sense of preservation in town, and everything kind of came together to really plant the seeds for the Lewis that we have today.
Fast forward to the present and briefly tell us the distinction between a beach town and what Lewis describes itself as, a town with a beach.
Well, a lot of the towns here on the Delaware coast were founded later. All the other towns on the ocean coast were founded in the 1870s or later. And Lewis goes back to 1631. You know, we still have light industry. There's a lot of commercial enterprises here in Lewis. You have this wonderful tourism economy. But Lewis sits off the bay. And it's about a quarter of a mile from where we are to Delaware Bay. It's about a mile and a half from here to the Atlantic Ocean. And, you know, being slightly inland just lends it a different flavor. It has a little bit more gravity here.
Mike, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Mike DiPaolo, Executive Director of the Lewis Historical Society. And thanks for ordering up this great weather as well.
My pleasure.
Now, on the other side of Delaware Bay from Lewis is, of course, Cape May. And many know of it as a place of antique shops and Victorian bed and breakfasts. WHYY's Tom McDonald explored some of the lesser-known parts of Cape May and offers this guide. Tom?
Well, David, isn't the easiest place to find, but the Nature Center of Cape May is on 17 acres near the Coast Guard Station. Sanctuary Director Gretchen Whitman says it's one of the best-kept secrets in far South Jersey.
Since we're here on the harbor, a lot of what we do focuses on marine life and the marine aquatic habitats. But we really are a multifaceted nature center. We do programs for all ages, for all different types of subjects.
Whitman took me into a garage transformed into a student-run marine center.
Not a fancy aquarium like you'd see, in museum-quality stuff. But what's great about it is the kids are doing this. We've got students working on this. So it's a way that they are involved with almost the interpretation of how you present this information to the public.
The interpretation is part of Cape May proper. There's a South Jersey marina. Marketing Director Mark Allen says they've changed with the financial times. Before, they got virtually all their business from fishing boats. Now mega yachts pull up to fill their fuel tanks.
It's 150-foot plus boats that come in here. A lot of them come in the spring when they're heading north to Long Island Sound. And they come back in the fall when they're heading south to Palm Beach. And that's a good business. I mean, they come in here and they pump 5,000 to 6,000 gallons of fuel.
Since a 2012 fire caused more than $1 million of damage, Allen says it's turned into a boutique marina, including shower facilities you'd find in a mansion and washing machines to send your phone a text message when the laundry is done.
There's a certain criteria they have to follow. They've got to follow, you know, stipulated regulations, of course. But barrels at sea, they can go out a certain distance, they can take the ashes, they can have a family, they can do a nice internment, you know, at sea, and that's good business for the guys that fish with us.
And that's what Mark says about what they're doing to expand the marina's value. On the other end of town, in Cape May Point, you can find a less permanent way to commune with the sea, the Marinus Family Retreat Center. The Catholic facility is in a home once owned by John Wanamaker. Yes, that John Wanamaker who owned the department store and was a summer home for orphans. Program director Jessica Sherwin says the center offers spiritual vacations.
It's a chance for families to get away and do activities, helping them strengthen their family life and their family faith life. And you can't do that when you're in the midst of everyday busyness, hubbub. You have to get away to just reflect and see where are we and where are we going.
Brother Al Cook, who's been working at the center for 50 years, calls the place paradise. He urges families to discard modern technology for a week and reconnect.
Just as I received the place when I first came, you cannot believe the atmosphere, the history, and the surrounding areas, the farms, lakes, ocean, museums.
Most New Jersey beaches, Dave, won't let you bring Fido or Spot, with the local exception of Sunset Beach in West Cape May. Doc Capuano manages the nearby Beach Shack Hotel and caters to people who want to bring even their four-legged family members on vacation.
We have fun doggy beer, we have doggy biscuits, we have doggy items on the menu, and we also have some pet-friendly rooms as well.
But if you really want a piece to bring your dog, come to Lewis. There's dog-friendly beaches at Cape Henlopen State Park, Dave.
I'm looking at Fido and Spot out there right now as we speak, Tom. And there's even more lesser-known Cape May, more or less, on our website, newsworks.org. This evening's forecast, mostly clear skies, low 67 degrees. Tomorrow, partly cloudy, high around 86.
Cape Bank supports WHYY and has proudly served the people of Atlantic and Cape May counties for more than 90 years. Cape Bank is a full-service institution and a neighborhood bank dedicated to strengthening the communities they serve. Learn more at capebanknj.com.
Whether you're just waking up or you're on your commute, the news is always happening. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. WHYY and NPR's reporters are covering the stories around the block and across the globe that will fuel your day and keep you informed.
So if your alarm is set to 90.9 or we're the first preset on your car's radio,
it's radio so vibrant you can almost see it.
And our reporters never take shortcuts.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first-ever Lincoln MKC, with available active noise control that reduces unwanted cabin noise to help provide a more pleasant driving experience. More at Lincoln.com.
Welcome back to a special broadcast of Newsworks Tonight, live from Lewis, Delaware. I'm Dave Heller. 50 years ago, the Cape May Lewis Ferry launched to great fanfare. Its history is the subject of a new WHYY documentary entitled Billion Mile Journey, the Cape May Lewis Ferry, airing tonight at 7:30 on WHYY-TV. And joining me now to talk about the story of it is John Mussoni, producer and managing editor of Delaware News, also executive producer of the documentary. John, thanks for being here with us this evening.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
We're going back 50 years, and there are some examples of that history with us tonight.
You know, 50 years ago, the Cape May Lewis Ferry launched, and one of the people who actually witnessed that is sitting in our audience tonight, William Miller, who is the first executive director of the Delaware River and Bay Authority, and was a big part of the documentary and really gave us the perspective that we needed to tell this story.
How did you come upon Mr. Miller and another example, Bill Schimmel, who worked on the Cape May Ferry? How did you contact these
people? Well, a lot of this was the ferry people, the DRBA, were very cooperative in giving us open access to a lot of the people and the places that we needed to document this. And Bill was right there in Dover, and we went down to visit him one afternoon, Shirley Min and Paul Parmalee and myself, and we spent a lovely afternoon talking to him and just getting his recollections and all kinds of things.
While we're talking about names, who put out the casting call for the aptly named Cape May Port Captain Brian Helm?
Helm, isn't that great? He's in charge of the operations over on the Cape May side, and he's got some stories to tell. Just the ability to operate a boat of that size is phenomenal, and he does it well.
It's a three-legged stool: Cape May, Lewis, and Virginia.
Virginia, the original ferries and the original boats that came up from 1963-64 came from Virginia. There was a whole ferry system. The Cape Charles, Norfolk area had a ferry system, and when they built the Chesapeake Bay and Bridge Tunnel, they didn't have any place to put those boats, and they needed a place to send them. They needed the money for them, and they ended up coming here to Cape May and Lewis.
Originally, the intent, though, was not to be as tourist-driven as it is certainly now.
Well, we have a lot of examples of people who use it to bring cargo back and forth. We have one guy, Boogie Hitchin, from Selbyville, Delaware, who his trucking company picks up shells in Port Norris, New Jersey, every morning at 3 a.m. He brings it down to the Cape May side. He takes the ferry across, and then he heads back down to Selbyville. It's probably a 9-hour trip for him, and most of it is traveling up to the Delaware Memorial Bridge. It's the shortcut that his drivers like coming back over the ferry.
And as you mentioned, the Delaware Memorial Bridge, some of the toll money from that goes to maintain the ferry. And there's another curious name, a Jeff Wright, who was in the right place at the right time.
Jeff Wright from Wildwood. He was the billionth driver to cross the Delaware Memorial Bridge. The connection between the two is the DRBA was set up back in 1962 with the idea of any crossing, the bridge, the ferry, any crossing now becomes part of this authority. And so the tolls that are collected from the Delaware Memorial Bridge, 56% of the operation comes from the ferry. The rest of it is supplemented by those bridge tolls.
It's a wonderful and memorable experience to cross the ferry, perhaps none the more so than for those who became engaged and or married. Let's hear an example of that.
I'm Holly Gilmartin. I'm from Wilmington, Delaware.
And I'm Michael Gilmartin, and I'm from Hoquesson, Delaware. And we got engaged on the Cape May Lewis Ferry.
A friend's company chartered the ferry, where family and friends were all in on Mike's surprise proposal to Holly. He had everyone form a huge circle on the dance floor, with Holly on one side and Mike on the other.
So as she was walking across the circle, I came across the circle and intercepted her.
My husband intercepted me kind of halfway and knelt down, and I thought he wanted to sit there, and I said to him, what are you doing? You can't sit here.
On bended knee, in the middle of everyone they cared about, he popped the question, and she said yes. For Rod and Andy Scott, they decided they had to be married on a ferry trip. It was August 29th, 1996.
The MV Twin Capes was pretty new. It had just been refurbished. It was kind of exciting and nerve-wracking at the same time because it was a regular crossing of the ferry.
So we had about
22 minutes.
22 minutes, more or less, to be married legally. We had to get on, get set up, and once the boat left, we had 22 minutes to do the whole ceremony.
Because his authority to perform marriages was strictly in Delaware. So we just jumped on there, got the show on the road, and then had a party for the rest of the time.
And the fun continues for the Scotts, who are nearing their 18th wedding anniversary.
That's a part of the show for tonight. And they're a great couple, and they've got a great sense of humor about it because they are longtime Delawareans, so they kind of know the turf, and they just kind of really got into it, and they wanted to be a part of that culture that is the ferry.
What also comes across is the passion of the people who still work either at the terminal or on board the ship as well.
You know, one of the things we did was we did this segment we call A Day in the Life. So on August 1st, all four of my photography staff and four of my producers, we all went on board. We got up at 5 in the morning. One of us started in Cape May. One of us was in Lewis. And we kept going all the way till midnight. And one of the things I got to do was I got to go down into the engine room. And first you get to see those things start up in the morning. They're like a freight train. And then on another ship, the Delaware, they were repairing it at the time. And you've got these huge pistons that they're bringing up. And they've got to like fine sandpaper just to make sure that everything fits back in place to get the thing running. They really love their work.
We have a moment left. When's the next opportunity to view the documentary?
7:30 tonight, 7:30 to 8:30 on WHYY TV, and then Sunday at 1:30 and on WHYY.org/ferry.
Thanks, John. John Mussoni, producer and managing editor of Delaware News and executive producer of the documentary Billion Mile Journey, the Cape May Lewis Ferry. Based on the attendance, the ocean temperature seems just fine for beachgoers here in Lewis, but how are those ocean temperatures measured, and how come they can vary so much from beach to beach in our region? WHYY's Mike and Scott spoke about varying temperatures with Josh Kohut. He's associate professor of oceanography at Rutgers University.
Josh, what are the main forces that shape ocean temperatures?
In our area off the coast of the Mid-Atlantic, from North Carolina up towards Cape Cod, most of it is governed by wind and solar radiation. So we go through the summer-winter cycle, and that has a big impact on the ocean temperatures.
So obviously the sun heats the water. Then what role does wind play?
Yeah, so one of the things that's very unique about the ocean off our coast is that it goes through, at least in the surface, it goes through the biggest temperature range from summer to winter of anywhere on the planet. So we have large changes where in the summertime we could have temperatures in the 80s, and in the wintertime, those temperatures could be in the upper 30s to 40s. And so that's a very big swing. And that's driven mostly, as you say, by how much sun is beating down on the ocean to warm it up. And then the wind acts as a mixer. So it's almost like a wooden spoon when you're mixing something for a recipe in the kitchen. When the wind pipes up, it stirs the ocean, and it moves temperatures that are either very cold near the bottom up to the surface or warm temperatures. It'll mix them down. And so the combination of how much sunlight we have and what the winds are doing plays a big role in the temperatures that we might feel when we're at the beach.
Now, when I go online and I check out what the ocean temperature is in Cape May or in Atlantic City or anywhere along the Jersey coast where I might go to the beach, where is that information coming from and how is it measured?
Most of that information is coming from either satellites in space, which are giving maps of temperatures. There's about 8 different times a day when we get a snapshot. And what those satellites are measuring is the amount of infrared energy that's coming out from the ocean.
Now, when I check the temperatures for some beaches near us, for example, Atlantic City and Cape May, they are about 40 miles apart. But the ocean temperatures, there can be a good 6-degree difference. How is that possible?
Yeah, so the one caveat to what we've been talking about in terms of the range of temperature that we see from summer to winter is that it only affects the surface of the ocean. It's just that part of the ocean that the sun's energy penetrates through. What happens below that, which is typically around 50 to 60 feet deep and deeper, that cold winter water stays there, and it stays cold. And that we call the cold pool. And it's sitting there reacting to the local wind. And there's a process called upwelling, where the winds can actually take that cold water that's sitting down deep and move them to the beach. And so you could have a situation where one beach is getting the influence of this cold water and another beach is not.
So it's almost like it depends on who your bartender is in terms of how the mix is going to shake up on your beach.
It has to do with the wind. So when upwelling happens, it's when you have these really nice summertime breezes from the south-southwest. And when you have wind coming from the south-southwest along our coast, because we're on a rotating planet, it actually pushes that warm water that we've been talking about in the summer offshore, away from the beach. As that warm water moves away from the beach, what replaces it is that really cold water from the cold pool.
As you track ocean temperatures over time, are you seeing a change?
The changes that I've seen personally in my research is looking more at that cold pool, that mass of water that we see near the seafloor that happens during the summer. And what we're seeing over time, and this is over significant time when the measurements have been made, is that that cold pool is warming a bit and it's also freshening a bit. And so we see that trend that's consistent with what other data sets have shown in other parts of the world as well.
Josh Kohat, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Lots of help with our remote broadcast, though. Special thanks to Tom McDonald, Charlie Kyer, Eugene Son, Chris Cetullo, Joyce Lieberman, John Musoni, and Carlos Fernandez. Also, thanks to Carol Richardson of the City of Lewis for helping to make this broadcast possible. Thanks for joining us, especially everybody, two- and four-legged friends here this evening. From here in Lewis, Delaware, have a fun, safe, and relaxing weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.